This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and you know there's a housing squeeze in the United States, especially with affordable housing. In Los Angeles, the city says it needs to build 57,000 new homes every year for the next 8 years if it wants to put a roof over everyone's head. But not even one-third of that number is actually being built annually. Not even a third. And why? Well, one reason: the cost of construction is sky high. In LA, the cost to build a single unit of affordable housing under the city's bond program jumped to $600,000. That's $600,000 per unit just to build it. So, I mean, let's be frank here, right? That is not an attractive investment for many, many developers. Unless you're Martin Muoto. He's CEO of Sola Impact, a development company building affordable housing in South Central Los Angeles. And Muoto says he can build housing at $250,000 per unit. Not that $600,000 per unit, but $250,000 per unit, which is less than half of what it usually costs. So how is he doing it? Does this sound too good to be true? Or has this immigrant American capitalist seen through the bureaucratic inefficiencies of the nonprofit housing sector and found a better way to deliver on urgently needed homes for historically underserved Angelenos? And if Muoto's doing it, why aren't other developers in other cities doing it too? Well, he joins us today to tell us this story. Martin Muoto is with us from Los Angeles. Mr. Muoto, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. First of all, before we get into how you've unlocked, seemingly unlocked, the secret of building affordable housing, I'd love to know about your own story. You grew up in Nigeria. Tell us about that.
I grew up in Nigeria. I happened to grow up in northern Nigeria, came to the United States a little bit over 30 years ago with about $440 in my pocket. But having grown up in Nigeria, it taught me a number of things. And one of them really had to do with what I saw in northern Nigeria, which was a group of people that over time lost hope, adopted a fatalistic mindset, and really were the early stages of what eventually became Boko Haram. It just really singed in my mind the importance of using every resource available to ensure people have opportunity, have access to education, and ultimately have hope. And so that's part of one of the reasons why I do what I do.
Wow. So I'm going to come back to that, because the idea of people losing hope and then turning to extremist movements is not one that someone expects to hear in a conversation about affordable housing. So we will come back to that. But tell me also more about what you learned and lived through and observed growing up in Nigeria about, you know, in your opinion, the government's ability to meet the needs of people.
Well, I think it's a case study among many of governments not really doing what they can do and what they should do. But I will say that I had the incredible opportunity to come to the United States when I was 18 years old on a full scholarship. I went to Penn, the Wharton School of Business, and it changed the trajectory of my life. And so I think what I again took away was that given opportunity, people, regardless of what their background is, ultimately want a better life for themselves. And that is really what brought me to the United States. And I think that the the lessons are really one that can't be replicated. You just have to have lived that experience of going from what is a very dysfunctional system at the time, and I think it's gotten better, but ultimately seeing some of the potential that the United States brings.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, when you came to the Wharton School in 1989, right, just a little over $400 in your pocket, that's all you had to your name, and as been reported elsewhere, a return ticket to Nigeria, which you didn't use for quite some time, I imagine. Then after going to the Wharton School, many years in doing corporate turnarounds, private equity firms. So you have a lot of background in finance. But what then, once you moved to Los Angeles, what drew you to this idea of becoming an affordable housing developer?
It was a little bit of the Darwinian process. I looked around not only Los Angeles, but broadly California. And I looked at various pockets. I did a number of, I did a lot of research to look at where both there was an opportunity, but really where there was undervalued assets. And what you find is that, unfortunately, in a lot of communities, not only is the real estate undervalued, but the people assets are undervalued, the cultural assets are undervalued. Ultimately, stumbled to some degree, but the numbers led me to start investing in the early 2000s in Los Angeles's Black and Brown communities. And I candidly, I actually started in Venice, and I invested in Venice, and that did very well. I invested in Echo Park. These were areas that saw tremendous appreciation. But one of my underlying rules is that I go to where I'm celebrated, not where I'm tolerated. So being a person of color, I could really navigate the streets of South LA very comfortable, which has traditionally been referred to as South Central Los Angeles. But you also see that this was a community that was still being judged by the stigma that goes back 30 plus years ago. It was still being viewed as the center of the crack cocaine epidemic and the Bloods and the Crips and the LA riots. And this history has stayed in South Central well past its time. But candidly, every real estate broker, every developer that I spoke to said, where are you investing? And I would say, yeah, I'm investing in Watts and Compton and South Central. And they go, you've lost your mind. You're going to lose your shirt. You're going to have problem tenants. You're going to be dealing with crime and evictions. And they were 98.5% wrong, 1.5% correct. But, you know, what the underlying premise that I developed, the investment thesis was very simple, which was the vast majority of people were good, hardworking people that wanted a safe place for their kids. Mm-hmm. And if you could give them a good product, meaning an apartment they could really appreciate and be proud of, they would ultimately work with you to keep the building safe, to play rent on time, to do all the normal things that folks do. And so that really was the genesis of how I got involved in affordable housing in Los Angeles.
So let's cut to what your central criticism is of how the affordable housing market has been operating thus far. Because I want to be clear, you're doing this, we'll talk about how, but you're building these affordable units at half of the prevailing cost because you're doing it with entirely private money. You are not doing it with any kind of public investment. So what is your central criticism of public investment in affordable housing that's led you in this other direction?
I don't know that it's as much a criticism as it is simply an observation of what has happened in Los Angeles, and I think broadly in California, which is that the primary sources of government financing, whether that's low-income tax credits, whether that's Triple H financing, it's led to this explosion of the cost, and there haven't been the incentives to really bring innovation and cost discipline and in some respects, just focus on driving down costs that you have in traditional private sectors. And so that has resulted, and as you pointed out in the preview to this, 600, 700, the articles about affordable housing costing upwards of $800,000, almost $1 million. And that fundamentally is not affordable.
Why do you think that is? What is it about, in your view, how, let's say, publicly subsidized nonprofits right now who are big players in the affordable housing construction industry, what is it about how that business works that's led to all these inefficiencies as you see them?
Yeah, let me make a point before that, which is all of these levers are important to try to go after the housing crisis, right? And in California, we often forget that this is the fifth largest economy in the world, right? And the number one issue that is facing California right now is the lack of affordable housing and homelessness. It's really driving people out of the state. And I think a lot of the government programs have really just, not unlike what happened perhaps in the 80s and 90s with defense contractors, where the cost just got tremendous. For a hammer would cost $800 when it was sold to the government. So I think, you know, it's less a criticism as an observation that there hasn't been the incentives in these other vehicles to drive down cost. And candidly, the bureaucracy of getting those funds, the availability of those funds, even the developers that use government financing find it takes years to get the necessary compliance done. It's very bureaucratic. It ultimately leads to these significant cost overruns. And that's just what the alternative has been for affordable housing for the most part.
Well, I'm going to put it more bluntly than you have, Mr. Muoto, because from what I understand, the incentive in terms of the investments you're making is profit. And in order to find profits in affordable housing, you've had to figure out ways to drive those costs down in terms of construction. So when we come back from the break, we're going to roll out some blueprints. We're going to go through material lists. We're going to talk about your cost of labor and figure out your magic formula for how to build affordable housing, as we're calling it this hour. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Martin Muoto. He's founder and CEO of Sola Impact. It's a company which works with investors. It's a development company to build affordable housing, right now mostly in Los Angeles, at lower cost and without public funding. And in fact, Mr. Muoto's company says it can build affordable housing at less than half the cost that it typically is typically required for housing units in Los Angeles, and he's telling us how he's doing it. So, Mr. Muoto, first of all, just really quickly, give us a sense. How large is your current real estate portfolio? How many units have you built and are managing?
So we currently own 1,500 units in the broader South Los Angeles area that we acquired over the last several years. We are currently in construction on an additional 1,500 units that are at various stages of construction and completion. And in our latest fund called the Black Impact Fund, we'll be building somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000 units, all in Southern California, with the majority of them in Los Angeles.
Okay. So that makes you a very large property owner and property developer in Los Angeles, does it not?
It does. And scale is one of the things that advantages us, is the ability to buy at bulk and use volume discounts. But we have become the largest Section 8 landlord in Los Angeles, and really focus on the areas like South Central, like Watson Compton, areas in San Diego. We only invest in predominantly Black and Brown communities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now I'm deeply curious to find out where you're seeking and discovering those profits in an industry that's been generally considered not a profitable one for developers. So can we use a case study here? As I told listeners, we'd be rolling out some blueprints and looking at materials list. There is a development that Sola Impact has called the Avalon Project. And for Angelinos, I'm going to give you the address. It's on, the corner of Avalon and 64th Streets. Is that right, Mr. Muoto?
That's correct.
Okay, so 28 units there. First of all, describe the units. How big are they?
They range from 300 to 400 square feet. We've got 22 one-bedrooms and 6 studios on the corner of 64th and Avalon.
Okay. And it's the building itself is 4 stories tall. There's some open space for residents and visitors, a landscaped roof deck. I'm not in Los Angeles right now. I'm in Boston, so I just jumped on Google Maps to see if I can see it. I'm not sure if the building that I see on Google Maps is actually the one that you built. So when did you finish construction there?
No, what you're probably seeing is a dilapidated church that was there before. It was a fire-damaged church that we bought about 3 years ago. And on this parcel of land, it had been vacant for many years and had sat there and, in fact, had been red-tagged. So you see a lot of these vacant, underutilized, overlooked buildings in the broader South LA area.
Well, actually, it seems as if Google might have updated its map, because the building I see there now actually is a 4-story building that looks like newer construction. I'll let you check that later to be sure that to let me know what we're seeing. But so how did you do it? First of all, let's talk about materials, because construction does seem to be historically rather wasteful. What are you doing to cut costs with materials?
I think that there's, and we've had this conversation with dozens of investors over the years to really scrutinize how are we being able to build at $250,000 a year. And certainly that's being challenged with all the things that are happening today with inflation and supply chain. But fundamentally, it comes down to being able to standardize your development and your construction process, being able to radically simplify it, and obviously being able to scale it. And so over time, what we can do is scale, simplify, and simplify in a way that we can rapidly repeat the process. So I think folks look for one big lever or two big levers, but really being able to build at these rates requires unrelenting focus on cost, and it's 100 small levers. We standardize the size of our windows across as many of our buildings as possible so that we can buy them in volume. Before the COVID pandemic, we had purchased large lots of wood. And because we have so many projects going on simultaneously right now, we have over 30 projects that are at various stages of construction. We can forward buy things like windows and wood and shower heads and toilet seats, right? And so every aspect of what we do is focused on ensuring that we can build faster, cheaper, and better product.
Right. So I'm seeing here that in order to achieve that faster, cheaper, and better, again, as you said, standardization, modularization. So I love detail. So we're talking about everything from not wasting wood and cutting joists to fit on site, but using sort of pre-cut, standardized wood, and even for sheetrock, you're just using you're having your architect's plan so that you don't even need to like cut much sheetrock and have waste there.
So, for example, we try to standardize on 8-foot ceiling heights, and with 8-foot ceiling heights, as you know, sheetrock comes in 4x8s. And therefore, you have to cut less to drywall the walls, right? And that's one example of over 100 that allows us to standardize. We went out to buy windows right before the pandemic, and during the pandemic, the cost of windows skyrocketed, and so the Avalon building is not a good example of this because it's got variation there, but we try to standardize our windows so that we could go to our window supplier and say, listen, instead of buying 32 different window configurations, we want to buy 4, and we want to buy them at volume.
Yeah.
We went to our lumber supplier and said, look, we're going to buy over $1 million worth of lumber, and we're going to store it. And in some cases, perhaps it's better to be lucky than smart. We bought right before the lumber prices spiked. And in the case of Avalon, we probably saved over $250,000 because of when we bought and the volume of lumber that we bought. But so every aspect of the process gets standardized. I will use, you know, a different example, which was that, you know, when we started doing our ground-up construction projects, we would often send out our plans or our massings to various architects to design. And often we would get the question, is this an affordable housing project? And we'd go, yes, it's covenanted affordable housing and so on. And our bids would come back 20% higher. And I'd go, wait a second, I thought I explained it was an affordable project. But because there was so much excess in the industry, just every aspect of that supply chain gets bid up to some degree. And so, again, these are counterintuitive things that happen in affordable housing that continue to drive the price up to $500,000, $600,000, $700,000.
But when you say there was, just to be clear again, for people who aren't developers, when you say there was so much excess in the industry, that excess was what specifically?
Meaning that the various contractors and some contractors and architects and landscape engineers and mechanical, structural, electrical, you know, all of the folks that have to help build a ground-up construction process, because it's primarily government incentives, they're not as cost-conscious. And so I think that lack of a profit motive really, in some respects, skews the incentives. And I've spoken to dozens of nonprofit affordable housing developers, all of whom are, in many respects, doing God's work, trying to build within the complexity and the regulatory environment that they have. And they're similarly frustrated with that aspect. I will say one of the things that we did over time is that we brought a lot of these pieces in-house. So we do our own design work. We do our own construction management. We do our own procurement in-house.
Yeah.
For example, most of the contractors and some contractors will mark up their materials 5%, 10%. And we write our contracts such that if you can't beat our price, you have to use our contracted pricing.
I got it. I'm just going to jump in here and forgive the interruption, but this actually makes a lot of sense to me. And, I want to call it sort of almost the IKEA model of affordable housing. And I do not mean that in the pejorative at all. I mean, I actually mean that in terms of standardization and scale very clearly can lead to the kinds of efficiencies that otherwise we can't achieve in housing construction. So that makes total sense to me. But the other major cost driver when it comes to housing is labor, right? And so from what I understand, when public funding comes into play with housing, that nonprofit affordable housing organizations are required to use, in some places, unionized labor, or at least labor that's being paid at prevailing market rates. Are you doing the same thing, or are you not using unionized labor? Are you using entirely documented workers? How are you saving? How are you finding efficiencies on the labor side?
So we, LA is a very competitive construction market. We typically don't use union labor, but we do pay what are roughly similar wages to a lot of the folks that are out there doing plumbing, electrical. I mean, those folks that are subcontractors are often getting $80,000 to $120,000. It's just simply a competitive field. And so I think people tend to point to prevailing wage or unions as the key driver of the cost. And candidly, I don't think that's really the case. It certainly accounts for 5 or 10% difference, but ultimately it has to do with all the aspects that go into building a project. So the prevailing wage issue, I think, is a bit of a red herring.
Well, just to offer a different point of view here, as you know, because Bloomberg did a profile of you, and in the Bloomberg article, they pointed to a 2020 study from the University of California that said between 2016 and 2019, construction costs for affordable housing in California rose 30%, and they found that the biggest factor was wages. But so just again, the reason why I'm pushing on this is because I really want to understand how you're pulling this off to see if it'd be possible in other cities. So if you're not using unionized labor, but you're paying competitive rates for construction workers.
Absolutely, and we use a lot of contractors and subcontractors that are obviously sourcing from the open market, but the cost of labor has certainly gone up. I pointed to a lot of the trades, plumbers, electricians that are today probably earning the equivalent of $80,000 to $120,000. So again, I think that's one aspect, but our primary cost savings really have to do with the overall construction process, the design process. Increasingly, as you pointed out, we have a couple of projects now that are in construction that are using modular, which I think will be another turn of the dial to get our costs down. Mm-hmm. I will say that, look, with over the last 12 to 18 months, we have seen increased pressure on that number because of supply chain issues, because of inflation. We've seen every aspect of the construction process continue to go up. Yeah. And so, candidly, we've just got to be more innovative in bringing some of these techniques and technologies, more particularly modular technology and building volumetric modular buildings, which means that we're really designing them from the ground up to be modular. And we think that's going to materially decrease the cost over time.
Well, those pressures that you were talking about indeed are touching everyone, including you, as you're trying to find more innovative ways to build this affordable housing. Now, I want to get to a big question about what your return is on these. But in the interest of telling the whole story here, I just want to give you a quick chance to respond to something, again, that Bloomberg pointed out regarding wages, that in 2020, your company, Sola Impact, actually settled a class action suit against the company by some workers who claimed that you had misclassified them as independent contractors. So the settlement there was about $500,000. Sola Impact didn't admit any wrongdoing. But do you want to comment on that? I mean, obviously, some workers were concerned enough to take you to court.
Yeah, I think that's the reality in California, the classification. Not unlike what Uber, Lyft, and others have to deal with, is that Certain categories of workers, particularly when they work a lot overtime, are considered employees. And so we settled that. It forced us not to use as many small mom and pop operators, which is unfortunate because I could tell you dozens of stories of folks that we used that were one or two person operations that grew over time to being 15 people that you know, worked for us for many years. But it is a reality. And again, a lot of that drove us to use larger contractors for the buildings that we were building. Mm.
So just to reiterate for folks, if I understand correctly, Mr. Muoto, Sola Impact is really working hard to deliver affordable housing to people who have been very often underserved in neighborhoods across South Los Angeles. And you're doing it at half the cost of what it normally costs to build affordable housing, because the big motive here is it has to be profitable for you and your investors. So what is the return that you're getting on this housing that you're building?
So because we have open funds and we're SEC regulated, I can't publicly state that precise return number. But really, we're in the high single digits and up to the double digit returns for all of our projects. And again, we find that we can find these properties. We can find this underutilized vacant lots. Often these are shuttered buildings, and we can build at that rate and really get a decent return for our investors and equally important for the community. I mean, if you drive South LA, and I realize you're in Boston, I'm sure you have the equivalent. These are areas where they have been historically overlooked and underinvested in. And one of the big challenges has been convincing, particularly institutional investors, to look at this area, to look at these communities and want to invest in them.
Right. Well, high single digits and double digits on an ROI sounds pretty good. So when we come back, we're going to bring into the conversation another expert in the affordable housing industry and see what he thinks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today Martin Muoto joins us. He's founder and CEO of Sola Impact. It's an innovative housing development company that works with investors to build affordable housing in Los Angeles at a much lower cost than the going rate for building affordable units there. And he's doing it without public funding. Therefore, providing housing units, he's got more than a couple of thousand now, in historically overlooked neighborhoods in Los Angeles. And we're trying to understand how he's doing it and whether or not his model of housing development can be scaled across the country. And I just want to listen briefly to one of your tenants, Mr. Muoto. This is Shaka Pruitt. She's been living in a Sola home with two of her kids for almost 5 years, and she described her apartment to us.
It's an old building that was renovated, but it is very nice. It looks like a normal building on the outside, but when you go into the inside, everything is new. It's newly renovated. So the bathroom is very nice. The kitchen has all stainless steel appliances. The microwave is mounted. It's very spacious. The rooms are not matchbox, you know, how some homes, the rooms are the same size and the same shape. It's not that way. The rooms are completely different, all of them. It's really nice.
And Shaka told us that her home is really nice, even as the surrounding neighborhood isn't.
Where we live is not very nice at all. I have to keep my children inside the gate. They can't go outside. There's people, transients walking back and forth, sleeping out on the sidewalk in the front, and just various dangerous activities that you wouldn't want a child to be participating in. That building is the sanctuary for us because we feel safe on the inside of the building. On the outside, you never know what could happen, but on the inside, everybody feels safe.
That's Shaka Pruitt. She's been living in a Sola home for the past 5 years. Well, I want to bring Mike Lofton into the program now. He joins us from Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's non-resident fellow at the Urban Institute and CEO of HomeWise, a nonprofit which builds affordable single-family homes. Mr. Lofton, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So, based on what you've heard so far, what do you think? Has Martin Muoto come up with basically a formula to build affordable housing that thus far hasn't been able to be achieved by, you know, nonprofit affordable housing developers?
Yeah, no, I think he's clearly on to something that's very important, which is the focus on cost and having a discipline around cost. So I think that what we're calling the nonprofit affordable housing industry is, I don't think this is an issue of whether it's for-profit or non-for-profit. Like, even nonprofits are focused on making money because they have to pay their bills. Mm. I think the bigger issue is the government, how government subsidy and government programs work. So there's a lot of the inefficiencies that Martin talks about and why it's $600,000. That's not only being built by nonprofits. That's being built by for-profits. There's money being made in that. I think the difference is there's not the focus that Martin has on cost. The focus is on how do I get more subsidy to cover whatever the cost happens to be. And so when you have that subsidy backstop, there's not a, you don't need to be efficient on cost. And, you know, and it's not because, you know, I mean, I think Martin's a very smart guy, but I don't think it's not like he's brilliant and understands a cost that nobody else does. Everyone knows about the dimensions of drywall. It's that there's no incentive. There's not a focus. There's not a discipline about controlling those costs. And that's what we need to, if we're going to get ahead of this affordable housing problem, we got to figure out how to focus on those costs and reward people who are good at controlling costs like Martin is.
Yeah, agreed. And in fact, you know, Martin said earlier that he thinks it's analogous to defense contractors, essentially, because there's right. No incentive to control cost there either. So what do we do about it then, Mike? Because if the existence of the public subsidies and the manner in which those subsidies are granted is not forcing or encouraging or incentivizing, is probably the right word, developers to be more efficient and cost controlled, what do we do?
Well, I think the opposite is true in a lot of federal housing programs, right, and subsidy programs. So for instance, low-income housing tax credits, which is a big subsidy for affordable rental housing, you know, the developer is paid a percentage of their total project costs. So there's actually an incentive to have high total project costs because you get a percentage of that. So there's not an incentive to control the costs of development. Now, what Martin's also using a subsidy, he mentioned that he was the largest Section mm-hmm. 8 user in his area. So that's a rent subsidy. That's a rent voucher, Section 8. And so he's getting a government cash flow to help people, that helps people pay their rent. But it only goes up to what they call a fair market rent. So he knows what his rents are going to be. So he has to make money within that that amount of money, right? So then there's a huge incentive. So you don't get to increase the revenue beyond that. You have to work within that. So the way he makes money is he has to focus on controlling costs so that rent is enough to pay his debt service and his operated costs and some kind of return.
Well, I'm going to get back to Section 8 in a second, but I guess maybe what I should be focusing on right now is, you know, we're talking about the overall lack of affordable housing, and that is truly a crisis in many cities across the United States. Mr. Muoto, given that Mike Lofton just said The problem is really the incentives, which we agree on, that don't exist to control the housing. But do you feel like you're actually building more than you otherwise would have if you were just doing it the standard sort of public subsidy way? Are you actually making a dent in the lack of affordable housing in South Los Angeles?
Magna, we've become the largest developer in the communities that we're building it, but you're right that it's not enough. We'll build probably around 2,000 units next year. And as you point out, there needs to be 500,000 affordable housing units built in just Los Angeles and 1.5 in California overall. So there does need to be more players in the market. We look for more competition, not only in Los Angeles, but nationwide.
Mm. So, I mean, Mike Lofton, would you agree with that? That this potentially, solar impacts model is a way to actually increase the number of affordable units?
Yeah, because he's doing it with controlling his costs, so that makes things more affordable. I think the other thing he's doing, and I think it's really important to distinguish between really strong real estate markets and weaker markets. He's focused in a weaker market where land is cheaper than if you're in the Bay Area, mm-hmm. And taking advantage of that, right? So land cost is like, because we're missing two other components of the cost of housing. One is construction costs, which we've talked a lot about. The other is what's the underlying real estate,
right?
That land. So what's land cost? And that's an interesting market dynamic. And then the others is what's the regulatory burden? So, and we've alluded to that in this conversation, right, or in your conversation, that, you know, some of that, like having Davis-Bacon, which is the what requires prevailing wage, adds a bunch of costs. Not because, and I agree with Martin, I don't think it's as much because the cost of the wages are so much higher. You have to pay competitive wages. You're not going to get people to come to your work site. It's that there's a regulatory burden of compliance that lots of contractors, like those small minority contractors that Martin alluded to, they don't know how to comply with Davis-Bacon. They don't want the risk of complying with that program. So it's bigger contractors that know how to do that, and they get a charge of premium because they know how to do that. There's just less competition.
Right. Well, so you've hit on something which I just I want to explore for a second, because a couple of years ago I sat down and had a pretty long conversation with a Boston-based developer, and I asked him frankly, I was like, "What's stopping you? You know how to raise money for housing right. developments. Like, what's stopping you from building more affordable housing?" And he said clearly a couple of things. One is expected ROI that investors had, and they just didn't believe they would get that ROI with affordable housing. The regulatory burden. As you just pointed out, that it was kind of just a pain and they could right. they could turn units much faster building luxury units. And also, you know, the cost of construction and land, all four things that we've discussed. But it sounds like, given the current state of the market and where Martin Muoto is building and his approach, that he's found ways around all of those challenges. So do you think that this idea is scalable in other cities?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, we do a very similar thing in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. Santa Fe is a pretty high cost market with home ownership housing, and it's, you know, and we will use government subsidies if it's available. But a lot of times, what we're doing is we're intervening in the market. So we'll do a high end home that can cross subsidize an affordable home. And so there has to be, I think part of the issue we're dealing with here is there's this history of how housing, affordable housing policy has evolved in America. And, you know, they even people who do nonprofits who do a lot of subsidized housing will call what Martin's doing naturally occurring affordable housing, or NOAA for short, mm-hmm. as it's some kind of weird phenomenon that just got discussed. The vast majority of Americans live in housing that is affordable within the marketplace. The subsidized housing is the outlier. And I think you've had this debate in policy for many years, since the 40s, of do you do public housing and try to replace the market, or do you intervene in the market to make housing work better, right? So from a government point of view, we should be looking at policies that help people like Martin be more efficient and more effective and get more done, not try to replace the marketplace and have a It's like housing that should not be a public works project.
Yeah.
It's something that has market dynamics to it. And if there's a market dynamic to it, guess what? You have to pay attention to cost.
Okay. Well, of course, the flip side to that is the very those same market dynamics in housing that have made so much of just market rate housing unaffordable to people and increased the need of, for affordable housing. But Martin Muoto, let me just turn this question that we're receiving from some listeners online to you, because listener Jay Sanders says, while the excessive costs of subsidized housing industry are real, this developer, meaning you and Sola Impact, appears to be targeting subsidized profits through opportunity zone capital gains tax deferrals, reductions or eliminations, and the fact that Section 8 rent subsidies allow market rents. So they want to know what you're actually charging for your units.
For a one-bedroom, it ranges from between $1,200 to $1,600. But as Mike points out, we have about 50% of our tenants that are Section 8, which are basically set by HUD. And it's a very important program. So again, it's a very it is a government subsidy that subsidizes tenants, most of whom have been recently homeless in Los Angeles, and provides them with a voucher that they can use to go to any landlord and find housing. Unfortunately, a lot of landlords, whether they should or not, turn away Section 8 tenants. But that is an important incentive. But those are the relative prices that naturally occurring affordable housing mm-hmm. goes for in the markets that we develop it.
So, you know, sometimes in really fascinating conversations like this, my mind tends to stop repeatedly at the same question. And at the risk of sounding gauche, Mr. Muoto, I've always considered, you know, capital in America is very, very good at seeking profits. Right? Like it, like the American system of capitalism is really good at that. And so the natural thought is, well, why hasn't anyone done this before? What you're showing that you can build more affordable housing, you can make it profitable for your investors, and it seems like you're serving a community in need. I mean, this is the holy grail, right, of market-based economic development. Why hasn't it happened before?
It's a good question, and I think it's multidimensional. But fundamentally, as I started, as I described, when I went into these areas, which are predominantly black and brown areas, a lot of folks, and as I've raised capital, a lot of folks go, boy, that sounds very risky. And these are communities that have historically been underinvested in. So I think that it's, you know, there's a reason why redlining was something that was regulated against. And so it has been certainly a challenge to bring along, particularly institutional investors, to really look at this opportunity objectively and see, look, you can do well while doing good. These are areas that desperately need large capital. And to some degree, you've got to really find ways to bring the community along. And I think that part, while we're focused very heavily on construction, and that's an important part, building housing is not enough. You've got to do more. You've got to make sure that the tenants see the benefits, the residents see the benefit, and the community overall finds ways to prosper. And for us, that's meant doing things in education, doing things in access to capital, promoting entrepreneurship. I mean, ultimately, those are things that ensure that these areas, really, you're growing the pie for everyone. And that's equally important, to be frank.
Could you potentially gentrify some of your current tenants out of their own housing?
Yeah, I think that the word gentrification evokes a lot of imagery, and it's certainly an important thing that we keep in mind. I will point to the fact that 96% of our tenants are racial minorities. They're black and brown people that have lived there for, in many respects, decades. But I think I also point out that the opposite of gentrification is really economic segregation, where all the poor people are residing in one area or in one building. And for us, really, the beauty of really developing these diverse communities is to bring people from different socioeconomic groups and really to ensure that young black and brown kids can interact with middle-income professionals and potentially high-income professionals and really give them the opportunities to expand the horizon. So for us, it's less about gentrification, it really is about shared opportunity and shared access.
Well, Martin Muoto, founder and CEO of Sola Impact, which works with investors to build affordable housing in mostly southern Los Angeles and now expanding into Southern California, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Mike Lofton, non-resident fellow at the Urban Institute and CEO of HomeWise, a nonprofit that builds affordable single-family homes based in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Mr. Lofton, thank you as well.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.